Conversations live Q&A event whips up another unmissable night as we put even more questions to new wave art rock pioneers, Devo. On the eve of their Sydney show, Devo co-founders Mark Mothersbaugh and Gerard Casale will be in conversation with 2SER's Paris Pomples. Devo in Conversation starts 7pm Thursday, December 6th at the Green Room, 156 Enmore Road, Enmore. Entry is free, but capacity is limited, restricted to over 18s. To ensure your place in the audience, email inconversation@2ser.com. Devo in Conversation, brought to you by 2SER and Grove Scooter.
Welcome to the Green Room and to In Conversation. And a very big welcome to
Devo.
Thanks so much for giving up your night off on this tour as well. You've been on tour with Simple Minds in Australia. Is it as exciting now to kind of step out on stage and play Devo's music as it was when you first did it? Like, is that buzz still there for walking out into a stage?
I used to get scared.
Yep.
But I don't get scared anymore. Maybe that's not a good thing. Sometimes being a little bit scared is exciting. You know, it's like sex. If you're a little bit scared, it's more exciting.
Absolutely. You guys met at Kent State University.
Yes, we did.
Right. You were both kind of enrolled in art at the time.
Yes.
Was that kind of like a serious pursuit at the time, like you enrolled in at the university to do art as a serious kind of career, I guess? Like, is that how you sort of envisioned it?
Yeah, I mean, I was a full-time student on a program, and I thought I was going to go on to teach art.
I was a draft dodger.
And I was a part-time art professor at another university, and that career got kind of nipped in the bud because it quickly became apparent what corporate reality was all about. And it involved Mark, because I showed his sketchbooks to the students, because they wouldn't keep sketchbooks unless I showed them exactly what they had to do. They needed an example. I said, you can do whatever you want, and that struck terror into their hearts. They needed to see exactly what they could do. So I showed the more tame things he did.
This was Ohio in the 60s.
And 70s. And then at lunchtime, of course, the most precocious, kind of sexually forward student.
Who was also a cop.
Yeah, could have been. Well, a
could
moral.
Have been. She
a
might
moral.
Be now.
A moral cop.
She was trying to be a cop.
We all left on a break because it was a three-hour class. And she went back in the room and proceeded to take the sketchbooks into her hands and look through the whole thing. And she found the offending material and reported it to the dean. So I got a call over the PA system to go to the dean's office. I had no idea why. And when I went in, the door was open. I couldn't see him, but I saw her in the chair crying. It was like the movie Election when Matthew Broderick gets caught.
I think it was a picture of a Devo hat. No, I don't know. It was something else, I'm sure.
If I take it back to when you first actually met, though, Mark, you actually met Jerry where he was actually doing a performance piece in an art exhibition. Is that right?
Well, yeah and no. I mean, sort of in... I was a freshman, and I kept hearing about this... I just kind of would hear teachers talking about this guy that was doing this stuff that couldn't be art, and it was really upsetting them, and he was pissing people off, and he had written some acid beatnik sex poetry. And I'd never heard of that. I was, you know, like from Akron, Ohio, and I'd never heard that there was such a thing. And so I wanted to meet him. And in the meantime, I was putting up, you know, now the graffiti guys, they figured out spray paint. It works really great. But before that, I had this really complicated way of graffitiing, that meant you had to silk screen images onto sticky back paper or dip in water and slide off like a decal. And so I was doing that kind of stuff and putting it up around campus. And so I wanted to meet this guy, though, because he was striking fear in the hearts of teachers, which was impressive to me.
And it was the same for me. I saw these decals that had been put on the glass cases in various halls around the university, like trophy cases, you know, where the sports trophies were. And here was a decal on the glass of a guy puking on the moon. And I wanted to meet that guy.
It was Ohio.
It was at that university, there's quite a roll call of kind of special people that went there, I guess. Chrissy Hynde was kind of there. Was she there at the same time as you guys were actually at the university?
She just was hanging around.
Okay.
I mean, really, she would come to the student union, and she was a couple years younger than everybody else and really not old enough to be at the university yet. But she really wanted to hang out with the older people and thought that she was cooler than them, so she would. She was nasty. She was very nasty and very scary.
No, not back then. She was just mostly kind of sullen and shy.
That's she quite a shy. Different rating.
I was in a band with her, the first band she was ever in, and we practiced in somebody's basement. I don't know. Do you have basements?
Yep.
Here? Yeah, because in California you don't have basements, so. If you say that in California, they don't know what you're talking about. But we'd practice in the basement, and she would go to the other side of the cinder block wall where there was the washer and dryer and sit over there because she didn't want anybody to look at her while she sang. She was different than she is now.
I guess the defining moment of those university years is the May 4th sort of massacre that happened. You were both there, and you both sort of witnessed it. I mean, I can't imagine what that must be like to kind of see that sort of thing, but I know it had a big impact on both of you. Can you sort of go back to that day and kind of describe what it was like to kind of witness that? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you find out what a little mouse you are. As soon as the guns come out and there's live ammo,
yeah,
and you... You know, I was a member of SDS, and two of the four students who were killed were my friends.
Send those hippies straight to hell.
And, you know, it had been a ritual, you know. Protest had been sort of a ritual. And we were protesting the expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia without an act of Congress. Back when students actually knew the Constitution and people... knew when it was being transgressed and the branches of government were not doing their job. Very different world than today where it's cool to be ignorant. It really is. Like, you know, what does Kim Kardashian know? Nothing. But she shows her ass and somebody gives her $10 million.
Yeah.
It was different then. You actually had to know something. And... the guns came out, and they were loaded with live ammo, and they started shooting at us, and it became apparent really quick when you saw people on the ground with big holes in their bodies and blood rushing out. I thought I was going to pass out. I almost did. I laid on the ground and kind of twitched like a little mouse.
He still does that sometimes.
Your life goes in front of you, you know, all the cliches,
yep.
Everything. And everything changed after that. All the big posing hippies kind of like cut their hair and went to work for their dads, you know, at the law offices or the factories.
At IBM, yeah.
They showed us what was what. They showed what power was and who was in charge.
Is it fair to say, because you had been involved in student politics up until that time, is it fair to say that the sort of the impact of that in some ways made you think that's not the way to change the world, that maybe getting involved in that there's another way, and perhaps that music and art was that way?
Or is you either had to become homicidal or suicidal at that point, and I didn't have it in me to join the Weather Underground, and I was too creative. So I think Devo was the creative response.
Basically, we became mimes for a while. Got out of that quick.
You know,
we broke through the box, and that was it.
Devo was a brutal creative response to a nasty, fucked up world where it's upside down, where idiots control it and power rules the day and good ideas don't matter and it all becomes really clear.
Mm. And the university actually shut down sort of at the point of that massacre. So is that when you actually got together and started writing, or had you been doing that sort of beforehand?
No, it was a year after that.
Oh, okay.
We'd done some visual things together, with some posters. We both really liked printmaking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We'd done some visual things, but never music before that.
So can you think back to the first time you actually sat down together and thought, okay, we're going to do something musically as Devo, and you're sort of conceptualizing that. What was that like? Like, did you have a couple of keyboards, a guitar, or how did you sort of... Because there were quite big visions for the band early on, conceptually as well. So I'm just wondering what a first writing session would be like for you guys.
Do you guys have Reese's chocolate down here? You have Cadbury's, so you don't have Reese's. Cadbury's is great, but Reese's, they had a commercial where two people collide and they go, "You got peanut butter in my chocolate. You got chocolate in my peanut butter." And it was kind of like that. We were kind of like, Jerry was playing bass in a blues band at the time, and I was playing synth, and I don't even know what you call it.
He was a progresso.
He's going to say
progresso rock.
So it's like it was kind of like the Jetsons meet the Flintstones in Akron, Ohio. So what they were doing there, we don't know, but it was us.
So in other words, it was a little bit of a mess at the beginning.
We were both playing music not on the level that we were doing our art.
Mm-hmm.
The music was genre. And we both knew that the genres were dead ends and not really self-expression. It was imitation. But there were things about the techno end of what Mark was doing and the fact that his friends had bought him some great equipment and things about the primal end of the blues and the bass driving sounds that I was doing that we wanted to keep, just the essence, not the stupid kind of genre cliches of 1-4-5 progressions or Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Yeah, it was like peanut butter and chocolate.
Yeah. So we just started being original. We started being
original.
A new
taste.
The idea is we actually charged ourselves with being original. We said we're not going to do anything that sounds like something that's already been done.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Great place to start. I guess you actually ended up doing some amazing musical things, like you know, playing in different time signatures. The arrangements were quite odd. That normally comes to people who are really schooled in music or have a deep understanding of how it works. So was that kind of stuff just? I mean, I know it kind of suited the twitchiness of the band anyway, and the sort of energy and the. But did you have to really try to do those things? Like, it's quite hard to sort of, you know, play in odd time signatures and for it to come naturally, I guess.
We always set up problems for ourselves on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just a game, like a class project, right? Like, okay, we can only use these three instruments and we can't make a musical change for 5 minutes. You know, let's see what we can do. And no part can play the same part as the other guy's part. So they all have to be different, and they can overlap. So it was polyrhythmic, and it would just be like that. It was experimental.
It made it tough when you wanted to play out in public. We found, though, that the technique that worked best for us was to call up club owners and tell them we were a top 40 band.
We did do that. They go, "Can you play Bad Company?" Oh, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere about the seventh song, somewhere about like six or seven songs, it'd be like, "Here's another one by Foghat. It's called Mongoloid." And there'd be some guy
who was out of work, got back from Vietnam, hated life, would go take his beer and go, "That's it!" And he'd slam his beer down, and then that'd be the last
That's
song
we
were playing that
night. It's not a Foghat song, you fucking asshole!
You know, it was great. We just became a kind of a
we were
confrontational band, and then we would be really excited that we got them that pissed off.
Yeah, we were a lightning rod for hostility in Ohio.
How much of the kind of industrial sort of sense of Akron, you know, made an impact?
Oh, a
on
lot.
The, yeah,
that was real.
Yeah,
it was horrible living there. It was real. We were pretty depressed people. You know, we didn't have any friends. You couldn't have any friends and be creative there. You know, the people that... Managers of McDonald's were respected there. And it was very anti-intellectual, and it was very right-wing. It was religious fundamentalism.
Yeah, right.
It was blue-collar. Believe me, they wanted to kill us.
I think the interesting thing I read recently was that Stiff Records in London, who you guys actually released some stuff through, at the time, at the sort of late 70s, they were actually saying Ohio was going to be the next sort of Manchester, or was going to be... They had that, even though there was really only you and, I guess, Pear Ubu that were kind of doing something quite interesting. And yet they pushed that whole thing, and you saying that, you know, you wanted to get out of there or
right.
You know, not actually be there, and they were offering holidays, you know, to
yeah.
people to go to Akron as a prize. That yeah. must have seemed quite absurd to you.
Stiff Records took a couple records that we'd recorded in our garage in Ohio, really for real, and they charted all over Europe. And so when we got calls from press, they would say, "And where are you guys from?" And we go, "Akron, Ohio," and they go, "Akron, what's that?" And we. So we said, well, it's a factory town, and it's overcast and gray, and it looks like Liverpool, and that's what it is. And they would go, so then it became the next Liverpool. So everybody who could play a guitar in Akron got signed to a record deal for about 6 months. It's true. Everybody from England was like, they were like knocking on doors in Akron looking for people to sign to a record deal.
Well, what I thought was really bizarre was that compilation that they actually pushed as The Sound of Ohio, I think it was called, or something.
Which there was no such thing.
Yeah. You know?
And that's the brilliance of marketing.
But you guys weren't actually on it.
I know.
We didn't want to be on it.
No, we had nothing in common with... we just helped them get their deals, actually. But...
And Stiff Records had the right name, because... They stiffed all their artists.
They stiffed us, that's for sure. We never got paid anything. They sold a lot of records, too.
So the first single you guys put out, this is before there's sort of loads of interest, you guys did it yourself. I imagine that was quite a mammoth effort to do from Akron. How did that kind of, like, did you... I mean, you would have had to save up quite a bit of money to press those singles and
yeah.
get that out. And then to actually get it out to the country, how did that sort of come about? Like, were there...
The daughter of one of the rubber company scions of Akron took a liking to us. And she was dating this guy who owned Portage Broom and Brush Company. And I worked there doing their catalog graphics for all their wonderful maintenance products, where the yellow suits came from. And...
No, we'd take the catalog, and we'd go home, we'd go, if we ever get our own apartments, we're going to outfit them with these kind of sinks and these kind of shower heads, because these are awesome. They look like, okay, I know they're for scalding chicken carcasses, but they would be great in a bathroom. And we were...
Yeah, so her name was Katie Myers, and
she's not here tonight.
And she gave us the money to... So the Mark and I drove down to Queen City Records in Cincinnati
yeah.
and
Ohio.
Pressed up 1,000 Giacomo Mongoloid singles.
Fantastic.
For Katie. She probably has Alzheimer's now, probably wouldn't...
And we paid her back.
It's that classic...
All $300 or whatever it was.
It's that classic thing, though, that then you've got 1,000 records, and what do? Because it wasn't like it is now, where it was a little bit easier, I guess, to kind of connect with people around around the country.
Well, you're right.
We didn't
have a record company, so we called it Boogie Boy Records, for lack of a better name.
Yep.
But it involved Jerry and me and the other guys in the band getting in a car and like driving from Akron to Cleveland, which is like about an hour away in the kind of cars we were driving. And you'd walk into a record store and go, "Hey, need any more Devo records?" And the guy would go, "Let me look." And he'd go down to the end of the thing and he'd go to like some bin in the end and he'd go, "Nope, I got the one you brought in a couple weeks ago." I go, "See you next week." And then, you know, you'd go to the next place. And that's how we started.
But then it got a little better. So,
yeah,
you know, we got them to Bomp Records in California and Stiff Records and a couple places, one in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then the underground do-it-yourself punk rock press started reviewing them and talking about them. And pretty soon, we had sold 10,000 singles.
I know. Nowadays, that's a big number, actually. It's kind of sad to say, but...
Yeah, full circle. It's a
crazy
big number again when nobody buys
music.
You
sell 10,000 records now, and you're doing good.
So how long after that sort of happened did the office, the serious office, start coming in for an album? Because I remember when I spoke to you last time, there was... there was actually interest in sort of signing you, and quite a lot of interest, and quite sort of varied interest.
Well, you know, with our friend Chuck Statler, who we'd met at Kent State University, who was a filmmaker, he had a 16-millimeter Bolex, and we made The Truth About De-Evolution, a 10-minute movie that Mark and I funded from working, doing printmaking and...
Graphic design. Like shitty companies in Akron.
And so we ended up with this 10-minute movie. But
we did come up with Russ Never Sleeps t-shirts for some Rust-Oleum place, and Neil Young liked it. He did.
In the summer of 76, I went to New York with this 10-minute film and our single and pretended to be our manager.
We were thinking he was never going to make it back because it's like 500 miles away.
And I met Alan Betrock, who had New York Rocker magazine, and gave him the package. And he got me a meeting with Hilly Kristal at CBGB's and somebody at Max's Kansas City. And I got us booked for the next spring for 77. Uh-huh. They said, "Okay, you guys can come up." Because the television was playing at that time. In those clubs, Patti Smith was playing. And by the time we went back in 77, the Talking Heads were playing, the Damned were playing.
Mm. Suicide.
And when, because...
That was the best band in New York.
And so it took off from there. That got, needless to say, a lot of buzz. And Kip Cohen of A&M Records in the West Coast then had seen the film out in California, because it traveled with the Ann Arbor Film Festival winners as a short. And he asked us to come out. He paid us $2,000 to drive out in our green Ford van. And we showcased at a club in L.A., and he quickly rejected us. He came in about halfway through the set, left before we finished. Called us into his office on that Monday. But
it was kind of weird because he was there for a band called The Clowns that nobody liked, but somehow there was a crazy Devo audience there that night. From Slash, right? Slash magazine? Yeah. But he didn't like it. He said, "I can't hum any of these songs." He said, "I don't know what to tell you guys. You know, it's like, let's say you have a bunch of 12-year-old girls in front of you, and one of them, you know, she doesn't shave her armpits, and another one, she's got pimples, and another one's got halitosis." And we go, and I went, "Oh, so we're not your kind of girl?" And he goes, "That's it, guys." So we left his office thinking we wanted to kill him.
So yeah, Mark's actually cleaning that up. This is our first face-to-face with a real A&R man in L.A., and he was describing them in more gross sexual terms. It was nasty. We were horrified. We were just speechless. And we stayed. I was so
pissed off. If he
would have
liked us, we might have gone with it more. But
I was so pissed off at what happened, I just refused to go home. And we got offers to play in these clubs over and over. We stayed the whole summer. It's what you do when you do everything yourself. You know, we had luckily done enough things ourselves that were right. We had honed our act in Akron. We had made a single. We had made a film. We knew what we were doing. We knew who we were. And we just kept it up. And we wouldn't take no for an answer.
So was there a desire to actually sign though? Like were you thinking if we do that we can go bigger? Because I remember there's the kind of you get the call from Richard Branson, you know, who wants to sign you to Virgin, and I'm thinking were you guys thinking, because I remember hearing that he was actually willing to sort of fund the whole filmic side of Devo as well at the time, and so I guess to you guys that might have seemed like, well, great, at least we've got some money to do some things, or. No,
he was our age, and he signed the Sex Pistols, and we liked the Sex Pistols. And, you know, it's like all the people we'd met in L.A. were creepy and unpleasant, and he was, like, an incredible salesman, you know.
Yep. Tell us about that trip, though, to Jamaica, because it's quite an amazing thing that happened there, I think. I think last time you told me about, you know, getting there and Richard Branson's real motivation for getting you over.
All right. Well, yeah. Mark should tell you.
Yeah, he got a couple of us to come down to Jamaica. Have we recorded our album yet? We'd already recorded the record with a...
Yes.
We'd gone to Germany because Brian Eno... We didn't have a record deal, and Brian Eno said, you know, we'll record a record. I'll take care of it. So he helped us record a record, and David Bowie was hanging out with us, and we recorded an album in Germany, and we were coming back, and on the front page of the Melody Maker before we came back for L.A., it said, they had a big picture of us posing at the Firestone, no, Goodyear Tire and Rubber in their in this room where they had like, this is how you make rubber. And we were posing in our yellow suits, and there was a picture of David Bowie in the corner of Melody Maker saying, "This is the band of the future." And so we were like, "Wow, that's great!" You know, but then we got all these phone calls, and one of them was Richard Branson. And so by the time we made it back to Akron, and it's the worst winter ever in Akron. It was 1977, and it was like snow was this deep. And none of us had jobs, and none of us had apartments. So luckily, we knew some women that did have jobs that would let us sleep at their places. So we were all crammed into these two apartments. And I remember the morning that Richard Branson called up and said, "Hey, you want to come to Jamaica?" Never been there. Bob Casale was asleep. And he was covered with snow because the front window had blown open in the middle of the night, and he just put his head under the pillow, and he was covered with like about 6 inches of snow. So I said, "You want to go to Jamaica?" And he was like, "Up for it." So we went down there, and as soon as we got to wherever you fly into, I can't think right now, wherever you fly into, we got into this hotel with Richard Branson. He was, you know, he was like 24, 25. We were all like young, and there was a bunch of guys, South African guys, that were part of Virgin Records at the time, and we're all sitting around, and they have Bob and me sitting on the floor, and they're all sitting on a couch around us, and they're talking about how much they love Devo, and they're saying, you know, our Sex Pistols just broke up, and we go, "Yeah, we know, we were in San Francisco, and we played Mabuhay Gardens, a punk club, the night either before or after that they played their last show and broke up, and they had come over to the where Jerry and the rest of us were staying, and then they announced they were breaking up, the Sex Pistols. And so this is a few weeks later, and I'm down in Jamaica, which is kind of nice after being in Ohio, and somebody was rolling these gigantic joints that were like cigars, and being from Akron, first off, we didn't have any money for drugs, even if. And whenever somebody had some oregano or whatever they would call it, you know, we'd wait all week and we'd go, we're all going to smoke this joint, you know, on Saturday. So we'd all sit around and we'd roll this, like, toothpick-shaped joint. And, you know, we'd drink a couple bottles of wine and there'd be, like, 7 or 8 people going, and they go, are you high yet? And we'd go, I don't know, I think so. Let me have some more wine, you know. Drink another bottle of wine. We go, I think I might be getting high. You know, and so when these guys are handing you these giant joints, we're like, and I'm passing it to Bob, and then he's like trying to give it back to somebody, Ken, whatever his name was from Virgin.
Ken Berry.
And then, but he's going, no. So he's passing it back to me. So they have us smoking these gigantic joints, and they're talking about Sex Pistols. We're saying, yeah, we think the Sex Pistols, it's horrible. They broke up with, they were our favorite band, and blah, blah, blah. You know, we're like stoned. And then Richard Branson goes, well, the reason you're here is because Johnny Rotten is in the next room, and he wants to join Devo. This is true. And I just remember, like, looking at Richard Branson right then, and all of a sudden I realized, take a look at pictures of him whenever you see him, his teeth protrude like a brain-eating ape. And Bob Casale's like, fuck, I'm really stoned. And it was kind of one of those things where, you know, then everything is like, oh, no, this is why we're here. So we're I'm trying not to laugh, and I'm going, I'm not laughing at you, Richard, because I'd never been that stoned before. I've probably never been stoned in my life before, you know, because we just had those little oregano sticks. And I'm saying, you know, we really like Sex Pistols, we really like Johnny Rotten, but I don't see how that would work. But, you know, if you want us to help out in some way, you know, maybe he should do like Devo. We're Devo Incorporated. He should become like Johnny Rotten Incorporated. How about that? Johnny Rotten Incorporated. And we're like, I don't know what to... And so we spent the next week with Richard Branson, and he almost killed us in a Jeep thing where he, like, slid off the road and giggled like a hyena. And Bob Casale got really upset and was like, hey, this isn't funny, man. You know, And we went to the Hedonist Club for a week where we met some really cute girl who said, yeah, all I do is on Thursday nights I go down to the beach and they set up a bar and they get all the guys drunk. And then I walk out at a certain moment with covered in whipped cream and all the guys lick whipped cream off me. And that's all I have to do. Once a week I do that and I get paid. And so we were like, this is not Akron, Ohio. We're somewhere else. So we went back. We didn't bring Johnny Rotten with us. And that was just one of the horrible things that Richard Branson did. But
is it true that he actually thought that would come about, that he'd already set up the sort of media conference to you know, if you sign now?
Yeah, I mean,
everyone's
how old
here.
Are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
45.
You probably wouldn't have been old enough to have been with either Melody Maker, Sounds, or New Musical Express, but he said that he had them all there, and he wanted us to go down to the beach with Johnny Rotten and announce that he was joining. And in retrospect, we probably should have done it, because if we would have brought him back to Akron, he would have died. It was so cold back in Akron, and we had such bad living accommodations that he wouldn't have survived, but... But
how long would Devo have lasted with Johnny Rotten as the lead singer?
Who knows? We could have been Simple Minds, and we would have been headlining tomorrow instead of playing second.
Tell me about seeing the Pistols the first time, though, because what was the fascination for you guys, or what did you see in them? Because I guess musically they were quite sort of everything was down to like the three chord rock thing. Really, that's a lot of what was coming out of the UK at the punk scene was like that. Whereas you guys were doing something far more interesting musically. So was it just the sheer energy of it, or?
Well, they wrote 3 or 4 incredible songs.
Yeah,
that's more than most people in the world, you know.
How many people can they write? And they were the recording itself. Was incredible.
Mm, yeah. So back to the first album, Eno kind of produced that, but there was a little bit of a fight to kind of, or lots of people were interested in producing it, weren't they? So did you actually choose Eno?
Did you? Yeah, we did. Yeah. We in some interview, I don't remember what magazine, some New York magazine, we said our first choice would be David Bowie and Brian Eno and Tony Visconti, because we didn't know anybody else, but we knew their albums that they had worked on and really liked what they did. So those were the names we said.
Yep. And I guess keyboard-wise and technology-wise, Eno would have been quite an interesting character for you guys anyway, because just the way he treated keyboards, sort of less as a musical instrument and more as a sound source or a way of making freaky sounds.
Well, whatever you think of, you know, about any of the stuff he's done, you know, he may have played one of the most important synth solos ever to happen. He played the synth solo on a song called Editions of You on one of the early Roxy albums. I don't know if it was the first one or not, but it was I remember hearing that and getting goosebumps because I said, he didn't use a keyboard. He played a synthesizer with just, I don't know what he's using, but he's not using a keyboard. You could tell it was really liquid and crazy sounding. And it was the first time somebody, because before that it was all people like Rick Wakeman and Keith Emerson that were like making synthesizers sound like glorified organs, you know. Yeah. And they were just kind of, they were kind of stupid, you know. But it's like Eno did the first like really sexy synth solo, and that was impressive.
So what was that like working with him on that first album? Because I read somewhere that you were slightly disappointed that you didn't take more of his suggestions on at the time, that it might have been a different album if you'd kind of,
you know what,
bent to him a little bit more.
Yeah,
I didn't say that.
I said that more than... Okay. But I'll tell you something. Jerry and I, it's like we were like, we really knew what we wanted Devo to sound like, but we didn't know how to do it.
Right.
And... He gave a lot of good suggestions. It's just that, and a lot of them are still on tape. They just never got mixed in because we'd go to the final mix and there'd be this thing that he had sang on, or he wanted to add his vocals in, or he'd have these synth parts, and we'd be patient, we'd listen to him, but then you know it's like you're in a recording studio and there's a set of stereo speakers and everybody's staring straight ahead. And there's this German guy that's mixing down, sitting down there, and we're all standing around him, you know, like listening to the stereo mix, and they go, okay, this is the mix we're going to tape, which means that this will be the final. So this mix would start, and then either Jerry and I, while everybody's looking straight ahead, we'd reach and we'd touch the Eno track and pull it down, and we'd all be staring straight ahead, but Eno, he'd look over and he'd like see that we'd pull it. But Jerry or me, we'd both be staring like really concentrated on the sound and the Eno track.
So that stuff,
you know, I gotta tell you something, he's never really talked to us since then. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah, more or less. He tried to make it pretty. He was afraid what we were doing was too brutal.
But he did do some stuff that was fucked up in a really great creative way, like in Too Much Paranoias. He found some really weird sound that we liked. And Jocko Homo, he did this thing with Monkey Chants. Where are those? Yeah. Ballet or something. The Monkey Chants go... And they get these rhythms. And he somehow... Probably we could get sued if somebody could find the record that he took that drum. But he made this loop, and it sounded pretty cool. We even tried to use it on stage back before there was technology that allowed you to do that. So Bob Casale would be sitting on this. He'd be sitting in front of his keyboard. He'd have like a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he'd sit there and try to hit the button on the tape recorder on perfect time with us playing, and it never worked. It was never. We did it, but it never sounded good. It was always odd.
So are you happy that you went the way you did with that album? Like, if you listen back to it now, is that...
We could have done worse. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are likable on all of our albums now that I didn't like then. And it was like, I remember, you know, it's just, there's so many things, and I'm sure Jerry's, you know, it's like, you listen to, I remember when Freedom of Choice came out and I heard Whip It, I couldn't stand to listen to it ever on the radio or in clubs because there was this, I was like, how did we end up mixing the hi-hat like that? And it just bugged the shit out of me. And it took like about 10 years before I could listen to the record and go... Okay, that's all right.
So were you guys like incredibly surprised by the kind of commercial sort of crossover success of Whippet and the two albums later? Because it's not long, that long between those albums. So was it like did it startle you that all of a sudden you were everywhere?
Well, I mean, it startled me that we weren't bigger, but I was doing everything I could to make us as important and as heard as we could be, and certainly Whippet was just one song, it wasn't my favorite song, it wasn't my least favorite song, it was like, I liked everything we did. The only thing surprising is that they picked that.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that?
Well, we took personal offense of all the bands that we hated that had better success than us, is basically what he's saying.
No, what I mean is you would imagine that they would have picked Girl You Want, that they would have picked Freedom of Choice, but for the radio to pick Whippet, I don't think anybody would have won a bet on that.
That film clip has still it turns up all the time and people still talk about it as well.
What? The film clip?
Yeah, for Whippet.
Jerry directed that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Probably the most important director of rock videos in the last how many years? 100 years. In the last 100 years, the most important rock video director. And he never gets the credit he deserves. That's the thing that I agree with him on that one.
Film clips don't have credits. Sadly.
So take us back to the time of your conceptualizing that clip. What was going through your mind? What did you want to sort of create with that?
Oh, we were punking people because that the song had become a radio hit. Unlike most of the videos we did where we were doing them in a vacuum with no input, this song was out there, and people already had come up with their own explanation of what that song was about.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it all went towards S&M and masturbation. We thought that was...
It wasn't.
We thought that was amazing, so we said, okay, let's just go all the way.
Any more than any of our other songs.
Right. So we just went all the way on purpose, to fulfill their expectations.
I mean, Reagan was still yet to sort of, make his sort of big entrance onto the political stage in a way. But there's something about that clip that kind of preempts it in a way.
Well, it's foolish, and we're making fun of ourselves. I mean, when you look at how we're dressed and what we're doing, we were self-effacing.
I forgot to ask you before, because I did want to ask you, did you ever get any sort of reaction from Jagger and Richards about the Satisfaction cover on the earlier album?
Well, we had to, because that came at a time when intellectual property was taken seriously. And we had to get their permission. We had to get their permission to put it on the record.
Oh, right. So what was their reaction?
So we went to New York and played it for Mick. In Peter Rudge's office, and it was cold.
Peter Rudge was broken up at the time.
Cold afternoon in New York, and Mick was all disheveled and tired looking and drinking a glass of red wine. And
he looked like Mick Jagger, though.
But he sure...
it was awesome. And then he danced, like in the song that they talk about dancing. He was dancing around. I'm going to send your picture to my daughter. She's got a phone finally, so she's like looking for things to do with it.
Yeah, so he after about 30 seconds of silence, he jumped up and said he liked it and danced around.
Okay. was there sort of I know there was pressure from the record sort of side of things to recreate another Whippet after that. To sort of, come up with the next big single to keep Devo sort of going.
Yeah, of course.
Do you feel that pressure internally as well, though, within the band?
Thinking, the same way. I mean, you just want to do good work.
Yeah.
Which then you find out is kind of naive. So,
we haven't really talked much about Devil.
I'm going to tell my daughter that you guys are all film stars, okay? And prostitutes and drug dealers. Okay. All right. She's 11. She won't know. She'll believe me.
We haven't really talked much about the devolution concept and all that, but I guess living now, it seems like it's just accelerated, like what you were talking about. We're just in, you know, meltdown now. Does it...
Yeah. Devolution is real. It's not an art school joke or a theory.
Yeah.
It's pretty real. And it's happening exponentially faster and faster.
Yeah. I guess it must feel really strange then to sort of be in America and watch that process sort of, you know, to come from where you came from and then to be here now and sort of be living in a place where people can argue something like, you know, a public healthcare system is not something that's desirable.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. So in the end, when you look back on your career and that you wanted to kind of make a difference and you know, drive home some pretty major issues, do you feel that art, you know, has your experience taught you that art and music can change people's minds and shift things?
No. I mean, here's what happens. Just to keep the world in check, there's a few people who aren't assholes, who aren't creeps, who aren't stupid, that do really amazing things and bust their asses almost masochistically, because it only takes, like, one amazing thing to offset 100 evil things. And the balance never changes. Hmm. The world's mostly always an awful place with pockets of coolness.
So at this stage of your career, what's left to do? Like, where do you see yourselves going now, and what you know, what's left to achieve, I guess, for you guys? How do you, like, do you see another album? Because there was quite a big space between, you know, the last album and the ones before that. Are you feeling creative and that you want to keep putting out music?
Yeah, but I mean, there's so many different and new ways to do that. I think, other than putting out a CD that nobody knows is out there.
Yeah,
you know, there's all kinds of things Devo could do, because Devo's an idea and Devo's multimedia. So Devo could do a musical. Devo could have a toy line. Devo
macrame, you know. Pottery.
The music could be embedded in other things, yeah. You know.
I mean, you've done a lot of film work, and I wondered whether, because I read that early on, that was the whole idea for Devo, was that you would be kind of multimedia. This is back, you know, before multimedia was really a term.
Yeah, just the opportunities are hard to come by because of the amounts of money you need.
Yeah. That's obviously changed now quite a bit. There is technology to kind of... So I'm just wondering whether, is that how where you see yourselves going now?
Yes.
We aren't going to get to do what we really thought, though. We thought we were going to be, we loved all the art movements between World War I and World War II in Europe. We loved Bauhaus, we loved the Futurists, the Suprematists, we loved Dadaists, the
Constructivists.
And we thought we were going to be like Andy Warhol was for New York. We thought Devo was going to be the factory from Akron, Ohio. And we thought we were just going to create artistic content. And we'd send out bands called Devo, kind of like Blue Man Group or Menudo or something like that. You know, we thought we were going to send out, like, we could send out half a dozen agitprop theater bands. And... nobody got that idea. Record companies, they didn't even get the idea of why you would make a film of a song at the time. I remember Jerry, at a merchandise meeting for our first album, they said, okay, guys, we're going to do life-size cutouts of you and put them in all the major record stores in America. And Jerry said, how much is that going to cost? And somebody at Warner Brothers in Burbank said, about $5,000. And he said, could we have that money to make a film? And they just looked at each other like, what would you do that for? You know, it was really, it was tough just to make little changes, let alone anything big. There was no internet, and if there would have been, it would have been different. I would love to be 18 right now.
Put your hands together for Mark Mumsborg and Joe Castell from Devo.
Thank you.
I must say, I can recommend the, what is it called? Girl in the Striped Dress? Kiss Me Kate?
Kiss Me Something.
It's a tequila drink that actually is very effective.